Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Sutter of the Democratic World Federalist, member of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. We welcome any viewers or listeners and invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. We're pleased today to have best-selling book author and freelance journalist Rhys Ehrlich as today's speaker at the Commonwealth Club. Rhys was born and raised in Los Angeles, but he studied at the University of California, Berkeley. He became active in the anti-Vietnam War movement and in 1967 helped organize the Stop the Draft Week. He's written for a number of progressive magazines, including Mother Jones, The Progressive, San Francisco Magazine, and The Nation. For public radio, he produced Jazz Perspectives, featuring Latin American musicians. He also worked with Walter Cronkite on such radio programs, documentaries as The Russia Project and The Iran Project. Cronkite once declared, "Rhys Ehrlich is a great radio producer and a great friend." In 1968, he made his first visit to Cuba, which led in 2009 to a book entitled Dateline Cuba, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Future of Cuba. He was back in Cuba just this past March. Among his other books are Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, co-authored with Norman Solomon. Also, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and the book featured today. Now for some background. As you know, the Bush-Cheney administration, supported by dual nationals in the Project for the New American Century and what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, launched three wars, one against Iraq, one against Afghanistan, and one against terror. We've learned that because professionals in the Bush-Cheney administration, including the CIA, could not produce evidence of Saddam Hussein's currently possessing weapons of mass destruction, the Office of Special Plans was set up in the Department of Defense, staffed by ideologues, to fix the intelligence, as was confirmed in the Downing Street memo, to justify the invasion of Iraq. In Afghanistan, we know that the U.S. was seeking to run an oil pipeline from Central Asia across the country, and that our military had already planned for an attack on the country in the summer of 2001. What about Osama bin Laden? After 9/11, when the Bush-Cheney administration demanded that the Taliban turn him over to the U.S., and the Taliban offered to do so if the U.S. would produce evidence of his involvement, the U.S. never did. And the FBI, which charged bin Laden with the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, in 1998, did not charge him for 9/11 for lack of evidence. However, as you know, this past Sunday, May the 1st, 9.5 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. forces killed Osama bin Laden at a compound in Abbottabad in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Pakistan. Now, to tell us about the third war, we have Rhys Ehrlich, who recently completed his book entitled Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Some may now ask, will bin Laden's desk make a difference in the war, or some say the phony war, on terror? Let's hear from our speaker, Rhys Ehrlich.
Thank you very much, and thanks for all the folks here at the Commonwealth Club who have arranged for today's talk. We're speaking 5 days after the formal announcement that of the death of Osama bin Laden, and I'm happy to report that President Obama was indeed born in the United States. and Osama bin Laden is still dead. You may not have heard the reports on this morning's news, but the U.S. announced that it's going to be withdrawing all of its troops from Afghanistan in a matter of weeks. Well, actually, don't applaud, because you didn't hear that news because, in fact, it never occurred. I just made it up. Yes, a lot of disappointment in the audience today. And the reason I made it up is because, actually, that would be a logical thing to happen, right? Which, if you follow the official reasoning and logic for getting us involved in the war in Afghanistan, things have changed. So we should be planning to bring the troops home. But, in fact, they're cautioning us, the White House and the military and the intelligence agencies and so on, are cautioning us that no, just because he died doesn't mean that Al-Qaeda's threat is no longer there, and we have to keep our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan and Libya. Or, well, we don't have troops, but we have to keep fighting the new war in Libya. And it fits into a pattern, which is that we go to war on false premises. We then, once those false premises are exposed, we come up with new reasons. And once those new reasons turn out to be false, you get the Trump card. And by the way, I'm not referring to the guy with the funny hair. You get the Trump card, which is, my God, things are such a mess, we can't leave now. And so you have the war on terrorism, the war that keeps on giving, because there is no way to end the war on terrorism. And it, in fact, sets you up for perpetual war, spending trillions of dollars, maintaining a huge military way beyond what's necessary to protect our country. But it's all justified by the war on terror. In the case of Afghanistan, we saw it where we were told after 9/11 that we were attacking Afghanistan because the Taliban had given sanctuary to Al-Qaeda, and we had to destroy Al-Qaeda because they were the ones responsible for 9/11. So that was accomplished in a matter of weeks. That is, the U.S. invaded, the Al-Qaeda split in shambles, ran for Pakistan, as did the Taliban leadership. And within a matter of weeks, and certainly no more than months, the official reason for us being there was accomplished, by, if you accept the original logic of the United States government. But, of course, the U.S. had no plans to withdraw the troops, because then we had to create a new government that was pro-U.S. And the real reason started to emerge, which is Afghanistan is a strategic country bordered by important countries in the region, from China to Pakistan to Iran. The U.S. wants a pro-U.S. government. It wants military bases. There's a whole host of reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with 9/11 and nothing to do with Osama bin Laden or whatever. But he was the convenient excuse. So the reasons changed. We had to have troops there because the Taliban insurgency might come back, or it was unstable and the various ethnic groups would fight among themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And besides, we're bringing democracy to Afghanistan. Of course, the fact that there were two elections with massive fraud, so bad that even the United States had to criticize, first presidential elections, then parliamentary elections, massive fraud, but the guy that won the massively fraudulent elections is still in power, Hamid Karzai. But his image is different. You remember when he first came to power, we see lots of articles about his caracol hats and his cape and what a sharp dresser he was and so on. And that was a sign of how well, I guess, Afghanistan was doing. And now, of course, that's no longer mentioned. He still wears the same hat and capes, but he's got a completely different image now. And, of course, Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan, where much of the insurgent leadership is located and is, in fact, being protected by the ISI, the intelligence agency of Pakistan. But meanwhile, we're continuing to occupy Afghanistan. And by all accounts, there may be some withdrawal of troops. We've got roughly 100,000 troops there now, but not down to levels where it's going to make any difference, either militarily or politically. We will basically continue to occupy Afghanistan forever, by the way, as the United States wants to do in Iraq. We have a treaty, say, with the Iraqi government that says all the U.S. troops, all the bases, all the contractors have to be out by the end of this year. And already the U.S. military is saying, well, you know, when we signed that agreement, we had our fingers crossed. So we didn't really mean it. And we want the Iraqi government to ask us to keep our troops there, because otherwise, my God, what will happen? There will be chaos. And once again, as the argument in Afghanistan, et cetera. And what the United States is doing, and this started under the Bush administration, actually even before that under Clinton, it accelerated rapidly under Bush and has continued under Obama, is to claim this phony war on terror as the justification for continuing to expand the U.S. empire, military bases, economic and political domination of other countries. And the U.S. intentionally conflates or confuses groups like al-Qaeda, which really are terrorist groups, who at their core want to see attacking civilians as a core strategy for their war on their perverted version of Islam. And groups like Hezbollah, like Hamas, or the IRA in Ireland, or numerous other groups, who are engaged in and have at times used terrorist tactics, but at their core are national liberation groups. They're seeking redress of grievances in their countries. And when that political issue is resolved, we'll stop the fighting and will not use terrorist tactics. But the U.S. intentionally confuses all of that into one giant war against terrorism. So you have Marxist guerrillas and Irish nationalists and Spanish separatists and Muslim extremists, all of whom are terrorists. And conversely, there's all kinds of groups who really do use terrorist tactics on a consistent basis, but if they're pro-U.S., then they're okay, they're freedom fighters. So examples, the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s using terrorist tactics to attack civilian doctors and nurses and teachers if they were pro-Sandinista, those were freedom fighters. And the Mujahideen in Afghanistan fighting against the Soviet occupation of their country in the 1980s with massive aid from the CIA and from the other U.S. Agencies. They blew up movie theaters because watching movies was un-Islamic. They assassinated professors at the University of Kabul. They did all manner of terrorist tactics, but their chief leader, Gulbuddin Hakmakhtiar, was invited to the Reagan White House and feted as a freedom fighter in those days. Now, this guy who at the time we knew he had thrown acid in the faces of women students because they shouldn't be attending school, engaged in all manner of terrorist tactics. At that time, he was a freedom fighter. Today, that same Hakmakhtiar, who has not changed his ideology or his practices at all, is an evil terrorist because he's opposed to the U.S. and he's fighting against the U.S. Same guy, same ideology, same tactics, once a freedom fighter, today a horrible terrorist. And if negotiations take place, it'll suddenly, he won't be a terrorist anymore, back again. So to explain this kind of in a wider context, let's go to Northern Ireland when I was there in the 1980s. I was there reporting about the Troubles, and at that time, the British occupation, military occupation of Northern Ireland was quite intense. You would walk down the street of Belfast, and you'd see soldiers in armored vehicles with automatic or assault rifles pointed directly at the heads of anybody walking by. They were that aware, I mean, they were that worried about attacks. And indeed, the IRA was engaged in armed actions against the British soldiers and police, and in some cases against civilians as well. And I met with a guy, I went to interview Sinn Féin, which was the legal political party at that time and today, and had included many former IRA people in it. And I met a guy who had just gotten out of a British prison, where he had been jailed for shooting at a British soldier. And so I was rather interested in that, and he had served something like 8 years. And I said to him, well, they jailed you for shooting a British soldier. What really happened? And he said, I missed. All right. So he went on to take me to a number of places. He took me to a place called the Feeling Club. Now, at first I was very reluctant to go to what sounded like an Irish Republican topless bar, right? The Feeling Club. But it turns out the Feeling Club was a place for felons, for people who had committed serious crimes, not like misdemeanors, you know, felons. So they had clubs, music clubs and bars, et cetera, that was only for people who had been convicted of felonies in fighting the British. And he took me to this place, and I explained that I had while not a convicted felon, I had been indicted for felony conspiracy for helping oppose the Vietnam War and the draft. And the guy at the front door, big burly Irish guy, says, "Ah, that'll do. You're welcome." So I got into the Feeling Club, and had a chance over a number of days to talk with this former IRA soldier. And I really, for the first time, got some insights as to the debate that went on within the IRA about this question of terrorism. So they of course did not consider themselves a terrorist group. But they did have a debate about using terrorist tactics. So everybody in the IRA agreed that it was legitimate to attack British soldiers, British police, members of the, particularly high-ranking members of the Irish, Northern Irish government, because they were fighting, in their view, a national liberation war against a colonial power. And indeed, if it's legitimate for, say, the resistance in France or other parts of occupied Europe during World War II, if it was legitimate for them to use armed forces against the Nazis or Italian occupying forces or whoever, then why wouldn't it be legitimate for the IRA to oppose with arms British occupation? But some people in the IRA took it a step further, and they said, well, not only are they legitimate targets, but it's legitimate to bomb pubs or office buildings in London, and knowing that it would kill civilians. So it's not just simply attacking military targets, but civilian targets. And the reasoning was that the attacks of this kind would cause such chaos and such anger among the British public that that would pressure the British government to withdraw its troops and to allow Northern Ireland to reunite with Southern Ireland, which is what their political goal was. Now, of course, I actually had a big argument with him on this topic, because I said, of course, in the real world, it has the opposite impact, which is if the civilians think you don't make a distinction, then the civilians see themselves as targets. If anything, it throws their support behind the government and makes you guys a bunch of crazies and terrorists and has the opposite effect of what you're intending. And he conceded that that was correct, because he was arguing on the other side, actually. But there was a back and forth. And if you look at the actions of the IRA over the years, you could see when one faction predominated and another, et cetera, and then the other for a while. Ultimately, they did decide that such attacks on civilians was wrong, and indeed gave up the armed struggle at all, completely, in return for concessions from the other side. From the British government mainly, and from the loyalist forces. A quick footnote. During that entire time when the British and the United States called the IRA terrorists, the struggle in Northern Ireland was always characterized as Protestants versus Catholics. It was the Catholic IRA versus the Protestant government or paramilitaries or whatever. That was never the case. And in fact, the people in Northern Ireland would tell you, on both sides, would tell you that wasn't the case. But it was part of the way the story was warped in the United States from the government and then through the media. Because you want to, you know, all these Protestant Catholics, they've been fighting for hundreds of years. How do you expect there ever to be peace? Of course, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then the minute the peace talks started and the minute the IRA had agreed, there was a series of steps where they decommissioned their arms and so on. But the minute it looked like there could be peace, then suddenly it was described as Republican, not capital R in this country, but Republicans, that is people who wanted to reunite Northern and Southern Ireland, versus Loyalists, that is people who wanted to keep Northern Ireland loyal to Britain. That was a correct way to characterize it. It was always a political struggle. It wasn't about terrorism. It was about sometimes the IRA using terrorist tactics. By the way, I didn't even mention the right-wing paramilitaries of the Loyalists who engaged in murderous terrorist attacks on the IRA and their supporters and non-IRA people as well, with the complete cooperation of the British government. We now have lots of documents that have come out about how the British used the paramilitaries for their own ends. So it's part of their counterinsurgency war. So the reason I mentioned the distortion about the Protestants versus Catholics is because there's a pattern here. When we go to Afghanistan, when we go to Iraq, when we start to see it around Libya, suddenly it's no longer us, the United States, as the occupying force versus people resisting that. It's the intractable millennia-long struggle between Shia and Sunni. They've always been fighting each other. What are we going to do? We just happen to come lately, Protestants versus Catholics. Oh, they all hate the Jews. They've never gotten along with the Jews. They're all trying to kill the Jews, blah, 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 blah. As a matter of fact, that's not the case, that for thousands of years, Jews and Sunnis and Shias in various countries at various times got along perfectly well, as a matter of fact. And when opportunistic politicians or emperors came along and wanted to put themselves into power, they would use that sometimes, that argument, and pit one against the other. That's true. I'm not saying there's never been any fighting, because obviously there has. But that to characterize that, for example, Sunni and Shia have been fighting each other tenaciously forever, and that the U.S. Is just this kind of bystander, is simply a lie to justify what the U.S. is doing. So let me talk a little bit about the situation in Afghanistan. I've been there four times since just a matter of months after the U.S. invasion. I got there in January of 2002. I was back as recently as a year ago. And one of the stories that I've done from there is to look into the drug trade. And on my most recent trip, I worked with a fixer named Najibullah, who I've worked with on previous trips. A fixer is journalistic lingo for somebody who sets up interviews and translates and handles logistics. And we were going to go to Jalalabad. We were in Kabul. And Jalalabad is a city along the border close to Pakistan. Actually, some reports said that the U.S. attack helicopters that left to kill Osama bin Laden left from Jalalabad. That's how close it is to the border. And the Najib came to me one day and he said, Mr. Rees, we are ready for our trip to Jalalabad. The road is perfectly safe. It has not been bombed in 4 days. And with that encouraging news, we changed into local clothing. That is, I got the shamal kameez, kind of baggy pants that they wear in Afghanistan, and a shirt that kind of goes over the top of the pants, and one of those rolled wool hats. I have a very funny picture of me in that, but we can't do a slideshow today. And interestingly enough, Najib and the driver also changed into the similar kind of clothing, because they were wearing like jeans and shirts. But to travel on the road, we didn't want to get stopped by either insurgent or government checkpoints. So we wanted to look like locals. We were in a beat-up old Toyota, and sure enough, we went. As soon as you get out of Kabul, there's a narrow two-lane road basically built on a ledge on the side of a mountain. And above you was maybe 500 or 1,000 feet cliff. Below you was another 500 or 1,000 foot drop-off. And you were on this two-lane road, barely wide enough for two cars. And people were still driving crazy, you know, driving as fast as they could. And, you know, you get to get up past two cars by... Can you imagine a full lane of oncoming traffic and you still dart out anyway with a 500-foot drop on either side? And nothing like barriers or anything to stop the cars. I mean, if you made a wrong turn, you're just off the edge. And it really gave you a firsthand feel, a direct feel for why invading land armies have had such a hard time in Afghanistan. Because one guy with a really big rock could stop a land army invading from that direction for a matter of weeks, because you put a rock on that highway and it's backed up. You can't go in either direction. So we got to Jalalabad, and I was going to interview some farmers who were a success story as far as the U.S. was concerned. An NGO in the U.S. had introduced me to some people who were going to take me out there who they had engaged in crop substitution. We all know that Afghanistan has a huge drug problem. About 50% of the GDP of Afghanistan is drugs. 50% of the economy. There is no economy in Afghanistan if you take away the drugs. It supplies 80% of the world's heroin now. That hasn't changed despite all the various efforts, but there were some efforts at crop eradication, and these folks had used to grow opium, and now they're growing citrus. So I went out, and I had a nice chat with them, and I did some probing. You know, they gave me some history, and it was quite interesting. They're farmers interested in growing a cash crop. And in the 90s, during the chaos of the Civil War after the Soviet Union withdrew, it was a great time for opium growing, because it turns out growing poppy is very simple. It doesn't take a lot of water. It doesn't take chemical fertilizers. You plant it, it grows. The drug dealers come by and they'll pay you in advance on your crop, so you get cash up front and then you give them the crop when it comes in. It was quite lucrative for them. Then in 2000-2001, in an incident that's forgotten basically in this country, the Taliban stopped the growing of poppy. Stopped it cold. And it was under a lot of international pressure, but they did it. For the first time in the modern history of Afghanistan, they stopped the growing of poppy. And it stopped the drug trade. So heroin, suddenly the exports dropped. The only place in Afghanistan that was growing heroin was in a small sliver of land in the north controlled by the Northern Alliance. The Northern Alliance were the warlords that were continuing to fight the Taliban, and they were funding their guerrilla war with the heroin trade. So it's a very lucrative way to pay for arms and pay your salaries of your militias and so on and so forth. Okay, so from 2000 to up until the time of the U.S. invasion, the Taliban had stopped the opium growing. These particular farmers were not real happy about it because it yanked out their cash crop, but the Taliban was too strong and they stopped. Within a matter of weeks after the U.S. invasion, they started growing the poppy again. And within a year, by the time the crop came in, from zero production of heroin, Afghanistan was back up to the number one producer of heroin in the world. Now, what we're told is that this is the evil Taliban. See, the evil Taliban controls the drug trade in order to fund their insurgency against the United States, and it's a horrible, horrible thing, but that's the reality of it. Well, I went to Kabul, and I went to see the head of the UN Organization on Drugs and Crime, the UNODC. That's the UN body that actually tracks drugs throughout the world, not just in Afghanistan, but in various parts of the world. They do human trafficking and a whole series of things. But they are the source to find out information about the drug trade in Afghanistan. They do aerial surveys twice a year. They publish accounts of where is the heroin crop up, or sorry, the opium crop up or down, heroin production up or down, and so on. And they take aerial surveys of the land to figure out if is poppy being grown, etc. And so I asked the head of the UNODC, what percentage of the drug trade is controlled by the Taliban? So he sat down at his computer and he did a little tap. He says, a little more than 3%. A little more than 3%. So then, being an investigative journalist, I asked the question that apparently American journalists have never asked. Who controls the other 97%? Oh. And he's a diplomat, so he gave me one of those answers, but with a little pushing, etc. The U.S. allies. All the way up to the level of members of parliament and the Karzai cabinet, including Karzai's half-brother. And not only, this is not a recent development, this is from day one. Remember I mentioned before the only place in Afghanistan that had been producing poppy was in the Northern Alliance-controlled areas? Those were the U.S. allies. When the U.S. overthrew the Taliban and al-Qaeda took a run for Pakistan, it was the Northern Alliance. So they had experience in running drugs. They wanted to maintain their own militias. They wanted to buy votes. You know, they needed money. So they went, oh, boy, now we've got a whole country to run drugs in, and immediately started the drug trade again with the full knowledge of the United States. This is not some conspiracy theory. This has now been – I detail it in my book with citations, and elements of the story have come out in the major media, including the New York Times, etc. And when they kind of confronted with this, these anonymous sources that will talk to the New York Times but will never talk to me, they say things like, well, yeah, that's true. We knew they were running drugs from the beginning, but, you know, there are no Mother Teresas in Afghanistan. That's the justification, which is that there's a bunch of bad actors, so you have to go with the people. You know, if we're going to invade and occupy a country, we need somebody to work as front men for us. And if they happen to be drug dealers, the key thing is to make sure the American people don't know about it, because that'll undermine the war effort. But the reality is it's there. And there's numerous, numerous cases of high-level Karzai government officials with the knowledge of the CIA and the U.S. military, engaged in drug-running activity. By and large, the U.S. media for many, many years ignored that. I actually ran a number of stories, and I write for mainstream media. I write for alternative weeklies. I write for web pages. I write for foreign radio stations like Radio Deutsche Welle and CBC in Canada. Deutsche Welle is the German language, or they have an English language service in Germany that's broadcast throughout Europe. And it's very interesting because I can, the stories I did about the drug running and the fact that the U.S. was complicit with the Karzai government officials, that ran in all the foreign publications. But when the same story with the same information, now we're not talking about, you know, Deutsche Welle and CBC are mainstream media for their countries. These aren't a bunch of leftist conspiracy theorists or something, right? If you have ever read or heard of their material, you know, they have very high journalistic standards. They ran the stories. But when the same story came to be running here, it got edited out. Because you have a very high bar. What I've learned over the years in my reporting is that if you've got a story that's critical of somebody the United States doesn't like, you can write just about anything. If I've got a story that Kim Jong-il of North Korea has 14 wives and smokes opium every night, if I've got one source that'll tell me that, it goes into the paper. But if I have evidence solidly backed up that the United States is complicit with drug dealers in Afghanistan, then the bar suddenly, they want pictures of the CIA guy handing off the heroin to the Afghan cabinet minister. In other words, you raise the bar so high that you can't possibly meet it. And that's the way it works. There's nothing in the rule books, there's nothing in the New York Times or the AP style book that says that's the way things are supposed to go. Allegedly, you have the same high journalistic standards for whatever story that you're publishing. In the real world, the more sensitive, the more critical it is of U.S. policy, the harder it is to get published. I'm not saying it never gets published, because eventually some of these stories did come out. And particularly on the question of the Afghan drug trade, when it was very interesting, because I have files of all the articles written by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and other major media about the drug trade in Afghanistan, going back to 01. And at a certain point, the Karzai government started to get antsy and anxious about the U.S. plans in Afghanistan. The war wasn't going well. Karzai figured he might have to make a separate peace. There was some backroom. He's starting to worry about his own neck, having been installed by the U.S., he started to object to some U.S. policies. So, for example, he started criticizing openly the civilian deaths during U.S. raids. He started to he refused to allow U.S. aerial spraying of the opium crops. Now, part of that was a concern for civilians, and part of that was he didn't want his drug lords' crops eradicated. So I'm not saying his motives were pure. But when he started doing that, then the U.S. said, oh, we put you in power. We're going to teach you a lesson. We're going to dig out our files and show the drug connections of your people, and we're going to leak it to the New York Times. And sure enough, front page articles in the New York Times quoting CIA sources about various high-level Karzai government officials involved in the drug trade going back years. It wasn't like they had suddenly discovered it. It went back to the 2000s at that time. And at that point, see, if you're in the media, if I had had somebody in the CIA confirming that this was going on, they would have published my stuff a long time ago. But I didn't have anybody in the CIA because they didn't want to talk about it at this point. That Karzai was cooperating with them, and so there was no need to expose them. But so that was the context in which all this stuff broke out. Now, we bring it down to the current day. The U.S. war on terrorism is phony. We get a set of excuses. There are incidents of terrorism that have taken place, and those groups are isolated. They have very little popular support. The death of Osama bin Laden will exacerbate that process. And there's the old al-Qaeda. It's not a centralized terrorist group that gives orders and carried out in various parts of the world. You've got basically franchises, you know, the kind of McDonald's of terrorism, where a local group sets up, reads something on the internet, tries to get involved, and carries out things more or less autonomously. In some cases, they'll name themselves al-Qaeda, but that doesn't mean they're under any kind of central control and command. And, you know, prior to 2001, groups like that were dealt with as a police/political/judicial issue. And there were plenty of examples in the United States of groups or individuals, small groups, who had tried to carry out terrorist attacks, who were arrested, read their rights, given a fair trial. They had no support in the Muslim community or in the Arab community because they were carrying out violent acts against civilians. And that is not supported by anybody, by any reasonable person. And those people are doing time in jail today. But suddenly, after 9/11, everything changed. Everything changed. Suddenly, our laws and our procedures that had worked perfectly well prior to that no longer apply. And, of course, it was simply the excuse, which is, oh, boy, we used to have communism. See, we used to blame communists for everything, and whether they were nationalists or religious leaders or socialists or actual communists, we could blame it on communism, and that would justify us backing every right-wing dictator and military junta anywhere in the world because we're fighting communism. Well, we didn't have an excuse for a period of time until terrorism came along. So now terrorism fills the same bill. So is there a problem with some groups carrying out terrorist actions and activities? Yes, there is. And they can be dealt with in a legal, and it, frankly, that would win the support of people around the world. The U.S. action since 9/11, the U.S. had tremendous support around the world, tremendous sympathy after 9/11 in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, throughout the world, in Europe, and Latin America and Africa, etc. And that has now dissipated because the U.S. used the 9/11 attacks to carry out all manner of military aggression of its own. And there's no connection between what the U.S. is doing today in Afghanistan or in Libya or in Iraq. There's no connection with terrorism. Terrorism is the excuse. And frankly, we can't afford it anymore. The U.S. wars figure $1 million per soldier per year to run these wars. So we've got 100,000 soldiers in Afghanistan, 50,000 soldiers in Iraq. That's $150 billion with a B per year to run those wars. We can't do it. And now suddenly they've come up at a time when we're talking about cutting Medicare and closing fire departments. We're going to start yet another war in Libya. I loved it because the White House was a little sensitive on the issue. So they said, well, you know, the missiles aren't so expensive. They're only a little over $1 million each. You know, it's like, oh, I'd love to see that. We need 10 new schools in San Francisco. Let's stop building 10 new airplanes and build the schools instead. It's not that big a deal. But somehow, for civilian priorities, it's always a battle about the budget deficit, et cetera, but for its unlimited, unconscionable expenditures for the military. A majority of Americans now oppose the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It's a solid majority that's not likely to change. Yet, Washington ignores the public sentiment and continues with these wars. It won't last forever. We've seen some examples here, the Wisconsin events where people were basically took over the state house and parts of the Madison, Wisconsin in protest. It was the initial spark, of course, was the attack on union rights in there. But they're very much linked, inextricably linked, because you can't. One of the reasons that these attacks on unions and these huge budget deficits are taking place in the states is because the federal government isn't providing the money that used to because it's going for useless wars. One of my favorite signs was, the Tahrir Square. You know, we are in Tahrir Square, is held up in Madison, because while there is growing opposition inside this country, the North Africa and the Middle East is going through tremendous upheaval, things that probably would not have been predicted prior to basically January of this year. And that is going to have a profound impact. If you notice, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Syria, all of these countries, there's no al-Qaeda, folks. They're not out there. They don't have a popular base or a program or a plan to fight for democracy of the people of the Middle East. They're good at sitting on the sidelines and claiming to be opposed to the U.S. and killing civilians, but they have no popular program that could win people over. That's why you don't see them out in the streets. And as a matter of fact, we see it. I think I'm tremendously hopeful about the popular movements throughout the Middle East, and we can get more questions, more details in the questions. But I'm tremendously optimistic about the popular opposition to U.S. policies here at home and abroad. The issues of the economy and the politics and the lack of popular support are coming together, and I think the Obama administration needs to be pressured to stop these unconscionable wars. And we'll leave it at that. And thank you so much.
Okay, our thanks to Reese Ehrlich for his talk related to the book Conversations with Terrorists, their views on politics, violence, and empire. We'd like to remind our audience that this is a program at the Commonwealth Club of California, and I'm John Sutter, member of the club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today. Okay, Mr. Ehrlich, we now have a few questions, so let's begin. We'll actually start with one that's in a different area. How can they solve the Basque problem in Spain? What's the problem in Spain, the ETA, be solved, or what's their future?
Actually, I have visited and met with separatist movements in Spain, and it's quite fascinating. Unlike armed groups in other parts of the world that I've met with, the Basque region of Spain is actually quite economically affluent. I don't know if you know that, but I went up to San Sebastian. It's a beautiful coastal area. There's tourism. There's industry. It's not a poor and impoverished part, which is normally the place where you have these kind of armed movements. The ETA, Basque Homeland and, remind me, Freedom, is it? I think Basque Freedom and Homeland, something like that, is a group that's been around since the 60s. They call for either independence or greater autonomy, depending on who you're talking to, within Spain. And they have engaged in terrorist tactics. There's no question about that, as did the IRA and as various other groups. I would not call them a terrorist group because they're not an al-Qaeda. They're a political group who will stop their armed violence at such time as there's a political settlement. The ETA affiliated political parties usually get about 10% of the vote. So they do have they're not a huge factor, but they do have a base of support that's been consistent over the years. I think you got to start with politics. The Spanish government has done everything that you can think of to crack down on them militarily and with police action. So they arrest leaders in Spain. They arrest their leaders across the border in France. The Garcon, the famous prosecutor who went after Pinochet, among others, he's well-known internationally. He also went after ETA. And he did things like close down the bars and restaurants who he claimed were affiliated with ETA and raising money for them. And it still hasn't changed the 10% support. So I think there has to be a political settlement. They have to sit down for greater autonomy. Spain has the basis on which to do that. Then allow ETA to become part of the political process and run in Parliament and resolve these issues politically as they have done in Ireland.
Okay. Back to the IRA. Do you think the IRA would not have taken the attacks to the commercial and civilian areas if England would have had a peace treaty before?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, yeah. The IRA is a political organization. Again, it's not a terrorist group bent on killing civilians as its core value or something. They did it because they thought this was a tactic that would win them support, and it didn't. Proof of it is the IRA is not engaged in any armed activity today. There are splinter groups that do, but that has nothing to do with the IRA. And the problem, frankly, is that the British haven't lived up to their promises that they made as part of the peace settlement. There's supposed to be a greater integration of the Republican supporters into the police and the civilian government. There's a variety of things that the British have not lived up to under pressure from the loyalist forces. But it's being resolved in a political way, not through armed struggle.
Someone asks, was Gerry Adams actually the military chief of the provisional IRA while serving also as the leader of Sinn Féin?
He never told me.
When 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudis, why didn't we wage war against Saudi Arabia instead of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, there's a certain logic to that, isn't there? The Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan. Why don't we invade and occupy Pakistan, right? Well, the U.S. doesn't invade and occupy its allies. It might engineer coups or overthrows of governments or whatever, but we don't invade and occupy our allies. But I think looking at the point behind that question, Saudi Arabia is a tremendous encourager of terrorism. and has been since it's as a U.S. ally, going back at least to the days of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan and probably before that. It promotes a very extremist interpretation of Islam called Wahhabism. And so it's perfectly logical, given that political slant to their version of Islam, that people would join in groups like Al-Qaeda, and that a lot of their recruits indeed come from there. But Saudi Arabia has oil. They have a stable dictatorship. The popular demonstrations that took place were brutally crushed. They sent their troops into Bahrain to make sure the popular demonstrations there didn't bring about a democratic government. So Saudi Arabia is a staunch ally, and so we'll simply make excuses for whatever happens there.
Who decides the definition of terrorists that is used in the United States? Do they originate here, or do they originate, say, the Spaniards consider certain Basque terrorists, the British considered the IRA for a while terrorists. Mm-hmm. Did the United States just assume that these other national liberation movements were terrorists? Or how did they join the
group? Yes, to all of the above. That is, basically, if you want a functional definition of terrorism, anybody who uses arms or violence that we don't like as a terrorist, anybody who uses arms or violence that we like as a freedom fighter. That's the simplest way to figure it out. And so, yes, the U.S., sometimes it borrowed definitions. The term terrorist and using it as an epithet goes back a long time. And it used to be hurled against anarchists here. And so there's a long history to it. But basically, if there was some anti-colonial movement that the U.S. didn't like, or that some U.S. ally didn't like, then they were it was assumed for those folks were terrorists. So I dug out stuff from the BBC and the coverage of Cyprus. Remember, Cyprus used to be a British colony. And the opposition forces in Cyprus who are fighting against British occupation were called terrorists. And Archbishop Makarios had a cache of Molotov cocktails in his home, we were told by the BBC. And, of course, it was all propaganda from the British. And with less than a year after that report, Archbishop Makarios was elected president of Syria. Of Cyprus. Sorry about that. So, yes, the U.S. Adopts the epithets of its allies around the world and labels people terrorists.
Well, that may be related to this. What is your opinion about negotiating with Hamas and Hezbollah? Mm-hmm. Do you think it would lead to peace in Palestine and Israel?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I know this is a controversial issue, so I will explain. I've met with leaders of both Hamas, the Palestinian group, and Hezbollah, the Lebanese group. And yes, both of those groups have engaged in terrorist activities. That's absolutely true. But then they are groups with a political agenda who are willing, under certain circumstances, to live with a two-state solution with Israel. In case you don't believe me, today's New York Times had interviews with Khalid Mashal, the head of Hamas. And I have interviewed him, and it's in my book, Conversations with Terrorists. He told them the same thing that he's told me, which is he's willing to live, and Hamas is willing to live with a two-state solution under certain circumstances with Israel. Now, that runs completely counter to everything the United States and Israel says about Hamas. They're evil terrorists. They want to kill all the Jews. They want to drive the Jews out and would never recognize Israel, blah, 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 blah. Simply not true. And the Israelis and the U.S. know it's not true. The problem for the U.S. and the Israelis is that Hamas takes a very militant line against current Israeli policy. And they have a certain political and military strength, and they have not been willing to play the game that Fatah has, the other major group in the Palestinian government. And the problem, of course, is that if the U.S. and Israeli-backed Fatah had actually been able to deliver a peace agreement, Hamas would be completely isolated by now. But the Israelis aren't willing to negotiate with Fatah either. So for the Palestinians, I think it's been a very positive step that they're reunited. They're setting terms for new elections, partly on pressure from their own populations in the Arab Spring, partly because of various other factors. So I don't think it will be easy. Hamas, I would not vote for Hamas if I was a Palestinian. They stand for things that I would not stand for, I would not want to see in a Palestinian government. But they are a legitimate political force with a significant popular support. They did, after all, win free and fair elections in the Palestinian Authority. Israel, sooner or later, will have to negotiate with Hamas. And suddenly, the terrorist designation and that they hate all the Jews, et cetera, or they want to kill all the Jews, suddenly that will disappear, and Israel will sit down and negotiate and hopefully establish a genuine two-state solution.
Here are a number related to Afghanistan. What do you see as a resolution for Afghanistan economically and politically, and should we be interested in any solution considering the horrendous treatment of women? And finally, if America enters into a political accommodation with the Taliban, is that success or failure for U.S. policy?
Well, it depends. If the new Taliban government is pro-U.S., then it'll be a success. They'll become new freedom fighters once again. Because at the end of the day, the U.S. is not in Afghanistan to protect the rights of women or ethnic minorities or anybody else. It's there to establish U.S. permanent U.S. power, preferably through ongoing military bases, but certainly having a pro-U.S. strongman in power that occasionally might hold elections. That would constitute a U.S. victory as far as Washington is concerned. Now, I have talked to NGO folks, very dedicated Americans and others, Europeans, who are fighting for women's rights under very, very difficult circumstances. They really fear the return of the Taliban, and I understand. And I think any political settlement that is reached should include a strong UN presence, not a U.S. or NATO or armed presence, but a strong UN presence that would at least seek to guarantee the rights of women and ethnic minorities and human rights in general. But there's going to have to be – the U.S. has lost the war in Afghanistan. It's not going to recover. The question is, what kind of political settlement will emerge out of it? Will there be at least a unified government in which the Afghan people themselves over time could get rid of the negative political parties that they have there? Or will it be a U.S.-sponsored chaos where you have people fighting each other and rather than have a government critical of the United States, the U.S. would rather see chaos? All we have to do is look next door to Iraq, where the U.S. could have a stable government with all the U.S. troops pulled out, but the government would probably be more friendly to Iran than the U.S. wants. So the U.S. could say, all right, we lost the war. It was Iran has emerged with more influence, but at least there's a stable government that's not antagonistic to the United States. That could work. The same thing could happen in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, there's people in Washington who would rather see people die and a country destroyed than to have somebody critical of U.S. in power. So we'll that one in Iraq we'll see by the end of this year. Which direction they're headed?
You talked about U.S. complicity in drug activity in Afghanistan. The same assertions were made of CIA in Vietnam, and I think there was also something maybe in Central America. Mm-hmm. What threads or connections do you see between these drugs with U.S. policy?
Yeah, not only those two, but you can go all the way back to the 1948-49 revolution in China, where the U.S. Supported anti-communist guerrillas in the hills based in Burma to attack China and this is the beginning of the Burmese drug heroin trade, which down to this day remains a major problem. So the way to look at it is that the U.S., particularly the intelligence, there's a split within the U.S. because the DEA, I think, genuinely wants to fight drugs. That's their job. But people like the CIA and some of the other intelligence agencies look at drug lords as one more political slash industrial group, which is if they're small-time drug dealers, forget it, fine, throw them in jail. But if they're people with power like in Colombia, for example, or Mexico, or some of these countries. These folks run, drugs are an industry. They're multi-billionaires. They have access, probably they have their own militias. They run, pay for candidates. They buy judges. I mean, they're huge. I don't know. They're like the mafia in the United States. I don't know. But anyway, so you have these drug lords, and if they're anti-communist or they're willing to cooperate with the United States to fight the enemy du jour, well, then you ally with them, and just as you would if they were making tires or drilling for oil or whatever. They're another industrial group to look at, and that was what happened. And, of course, if you've got an insurgent group, running drugs is a really good way to fund that. Because it's an off-the-books way, and you don't have to put out so many taxpayer dollars. You know, you just hook the taxpayers on drugs. So the biggest single thing the United States could do to stop this kind of drug trade is to reduce the demand for it in the United States. Make, you know, cocaine, heroin, and other drug addictions, make treatment available on demand, significantly reduce the need for it here, which would both help our own people and do go a long way to undercutting all these drug lords around the world.
Here's one about Iran. And I think after 9/11, Iran sided with the U.S. in trying to capture some al-Qaeda activists. Does Iran's does it promote terrorism by its religious wars, in effect, Sunni, Shia, and I guess you might also say Baha'i?
Well, there's no question that the government in Iran is tremendously repressive. And at times, they have sponsored groups that engaged in terrorist activity. I think that's true. That's different from saying it's a state sponsor of terrorism. It's the same distinction. I mean, they hate al-Qaeda, just as an example. They almost went to war with the Taliban, because the Taliban murdered a bunch of Iranian diplomats in Mazar-e-Sharif, and Iran sent troops to the Afghan border. So that brand of terrorist groups, the Iranians have no truck with. They are two things. They are a tremendously repressive government. I was there after the 2009 elections and saw the Green Movement in its original stages and have continued to follow that. The people of Iran are perfectly capable of, on their own, with time, removing a repressive government. But that doesn't mean that they're going to suddenly embrace the United States and U.S. policies. Let's keep that in mind. And that's true throughout the Middle East. You know, these popular movements are not rising up so that we can have a pro-U.S. strongman controlling the oil resources. The people of Iran support the Palestinians. They support freedom and independence movements. And on the foreign policy issues, I'm not talking about army, you know, sending arms to terrorist groups, but I'm talking about on the basic political issues. The people of Iran reflect the government policies in Iran on those issues. So, anyway, let's kind of keep that in mind. That when we have these democratic movements, the version that we get in this country through the government and the media is often a distorted version of what they stand for.
Okay, back to basics. What were al-Qaeda's motives? Is it about U.S. support of Middle East monarchies and involvement of Israel, or is it about spreading their version of Sharia?
Mm-hmm. Okay, al-Qaeda is a quite bizarre group when you actually look at their political views. They want to establish a Muslim caliphate that would stretch from Spain to Indonesia, the old Arab Muslim empire of 1,000-plus years ago. This is something that nobody supports. None of the democratic movements, even Hezbollah and Hamas, nobody supports that because it's so out to lunch. And in order to establish that, you have to kill, presumably you have to drive all those folks out who happen to be living there, not only the Christians and the Jews and the other non-Muslims, but all the Muslims that don't agree with you. So you got to talk about a long-term task. So it's so bizarre, it's so out of touch with reality. That's one of the reasons they've never been able to gather popular support. They have opportunistically latched onto, for example, the Palestinian struggle. So they pay lip service to supporting the Palestinians against the struggle against Israel. But they haven't actually done anything about it. In fact, that's one of the complaints the Palestinians I talked to both in Lebanon and in the West Bank and Gaza. There's no support, popular support for them. They will opportunistically claim to support various popular causes, and they denounce U.S. imperialism in the same way. But they have their own bizarre twist on history.
Well, We've reached the point where there's time for only one more question, and it is, what can we as citizens do to stop these wars? It hasn't worked so far.
Well, you know, those in power are darn strong, they're darn clever, and they lie a lot. And I remember the Vietnam War, where the popular opinion turned against the Vietnam War decidedly, roughly in 1968. It took another seven, 8 years before the U.S. actually pulled out of Vietnam. And that was a combination of the cost, the fighting on the ground, but the continuing anti-war movement. I think we're hitting a turning point with Iraq. If the U.S. tries to keep significant number of troops in Iraq after the end of this year, there'll be huge protests in Iraq, and I think there'll be big protests here. So what can you do? Get involved. Engage in legal political opposition, you know, go to rallies, write letters, organize. The government, luckily, we're not living under a Mubarak. the government does and can respond to pressure. Exercise your democratic rights.
Well, our thanks to Reese Ehrlich, speaker on Conversations with Terrorists, their views on politics, violence, and empire, for enlightening us today. We also thank our audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.